good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
Issues we discussed about Kenya and how we can access resources within the multilateral development banks, how the U.S. was going to work with Kenya in providing guarantees for us to access the markets, and many other things around Kenya.
Kenya's President William Ruto wraps up his state visit to Washington.
I think Ghana should trust me to bring change because I can. As simple as that. Whatever I talk about, I have not only heard about it or seen it, I have also lived it. So I know what I'm talking about.
A Rwandan businesswoman plans to compete as a presidential candidate in the coming July election.
Research consulted widely with our members, and we have come to the conclusion that considering the high cost of living vis-a-vis inflation in Nigeria, and the only thing that can reasonably take the worker home is 497,000 in a month.
And Nigeria's Trade Union Congress, or TUC, demands a new minimum wage to help cushion the effects of the economic challenges facing the country. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Kenya's President William Ruto has wrapped up his state visit to Washington, which focused heavily on trade, international finance, and economic development. In an exclusive VOA interview, Ruto says he is pleased with the progress he made on the trip in broadening trade with the United States. He spoke with my colleague Huba Abdi with the VOA Swahili service on a range of issues. In his first segment of the talk, he discussed his talks with U.S. officials on economic issues.
I think we have agreed that as a continent, and by the way, I had a meeting of the World Bank with 21 other heads of state in Nairobi a month ago to discuss the whole debt management infrastructure. And one of the issues that we agreed on is to make sure that the international financial architecture is not unfair to countries like Kenya, that we pay the same in terms of interest like other countries. As it is now, countries in the developing world, including Kenya, pay between 5 and 8 times more for interest for the same resources that are available in the global markets. So the conversation that we had with the United States is that they will lead and they will champion. And we appreciate that everybody has now come to agree that we need a fairer international financial architecture. And it is the reason why the United States have committed $250 billion and specifically $21 billion to the concessionary window of the World Bank under IDA so that we can reach the target which we set in Nairobi of $120 billion. Mm-hmm. That will support developing countries like Kenya, access concessionary financing so that countries do not spend more in debt repayment and in managing the effects of climate change, but they will spend more in development, in health, in education, in social services. President Biden and the senators and the congressmen have agreed to double U.S. contribution to the IDA window so that we can be able to do more with our resources and be able to access more concessionary funding.
You've talked about debt restructuring and possible relief, given that Kenya owes about $82 billion. Was this part of your talks, and what do you expect from the U.S.?
We were discussing not necessarily a Kenyan product. I think there are issues we discussed about Kenya and how we can access resources within the multilateral development banks, how the U.S. was going to work with Kenya in providing guarantees for us to access the markets, and many other things around Kenya and what the U.S. can do together with Kenya in areas of creating more investment tools, making sure that we also use the private sector, leverage on the private sector to get more resources. For example, we signed a $1 billion investment in Kenya by Microsoft, G42 of UAE, and EcoCloud of Kenya. So there are different investment tools that we worked with, but specifically on matters to do with debt and infrastructure, our discussions were around how do we broadly re-engineer the international financial architecture to make it agile, to make it much more responsive to climate financing, where we are swinging from drought into floods and vice versa. We need a financial system that gives us long-term financing with adequate grace period and also that is flexible.
Let's talk about AGOA. You are advocating for a renewal of this agreement. Would you like to see more changes in this agreement in regards to having Kenyans and other African countries to be part of this agreement?
I think AGOA is working pretty well, even in its current form. Last year, for example, Kenya exported $544 million, close to 70, 80 billion worth of goods to the United States, quota-free, duty-free. It is a window that gives us opportunity to expand our job creation facilities in our special economic zones. I think last year we added 12,000 jobs under this program, and I am very happy with the outcome of my conversation, both at the Hill and at the White House. And I want to thank President Biden for the support that he has given for the renewal of AGOA, which is not going to be just a Kenyan facility. It is an African facility that will support the whole continent.
That was President William Ruto of Kenya, who just ended a landmark state visit to Washington. He was speaking with my colleague Huba Abdi. Tomorrow, we'll hear from Ruto as he addresses concerns about the planned Kenyan police mission to Haiti and discuss climate change challenges. You can find more reporting on President Ruto's visit on voaafrica.com and voaswahili.com. Diane Shima Rigara, a Rwandan businesswoman and accountant, says she plans to compete as a presidential candidate in the coming July election. She made the announcement to challenge incumbent President Paul Kagame on the social media platform X, formerly called Twitter. Rigara stood as an independent candidate in 2017 presidential election, but was disqualified by the National Electoral Commission on technical grounds. This time, however, she promises victory and to become Rwanda's first female president. For more about her vision and plans for Rwanda, I reached Diane Shima Rigara in the capital, Kigali.
My vision for Rwanda is for people, for Rwandans, to afford the basics of life, like food, water, shelter, for them to be able to work and enjoy the fruits of their labor without the state constantly interfering. The reason why I say that is because it's easy for foreigners to come and do business in Rwanda, but it's not as easy for Rwandans. So that's why I'm saying and I insist on the fact that Rwandans should be able to work and should be given priority. It's good to have foreign investment. It's needed. It's even better when the people are able to contribute to the development of the country.
Why should the people of Rwanda trust you to bring that change? What makes you uniquely qualified to bring about the change that you are trying to convince them that you want to bring?
I think Rwanda should trust me to bring change because I can. As simple as that. Whatever I talk about, I have not only heard about it or seen it, I have also lived it. So I know what I'm talking about. I'm passionate about this work, and I will not give up until Rwanda has changed for the better. I mean, I'm not saying that there hasn't been any progress. No, there has been. But I definitely think we can do even better.
You know, Rwanda is a patrilineal society, although there's a lot of women in parliament. But do you think the Rwandan society as you have now will rather choose you, especially the country's president, who they think has brought about change, has brought about progress, is attracting a lot of investment? Do you think you really stand a chance of becoming the next president of Rwanda?
Yes, I do think I can become the next president of Rwanda if the elections were to be free and fair. If Rwandans are given a choice, the main problem in Rwanda is that people are afraid to speak up, because when you dare to stand up and speak, you become the target of so much hate. So many people are afraid to speak their mind. But if they were given a chance or an opportunity to express themselves, of course they would thank the president for what has been achieved, but other people would deserve a chance to work for their country. I think they would vote for me.
Diane Shima Regara is a Rwandan businesswoman and accountant. She spoke with me from the capital, Kigali. While many critics, such as Regara, say Rwanda's government suppresses critics, President Paul Kagame and his government have denied those accusations. Kagame, who led the country's recovery from the 1994 genocide against ethnic Tutsi, remains highly popular. In Uganda, Gawaya Tegule, a prominent human rights lawyer and a prolific legal writer, is expressing a lack of excitement for the newly appointed Inspector General of Police. His reaction comes after President Yoweri Museveni appointed Abbas Biakagaba, a retired police officer, to become the head of the police. He takes over from Martin Okoth Ochola, who retired in March. Until his retirement, Biakagaba was the Assistant General of Police. He also had worked as police director for counterterrorism. Some human rights activists and civil society say they do not expect the new police chief to crack down on police officers who abuse the rights of citizens. Biakagaba's supporters, however, say he should be given time to demonstrate his commitment to the rule of law and the protection of life and property. For more reaction regarding the appointment of the new police chief, I reach human rights lawyer Gawaya Tegule.
I can guarantee there is no excitement, at least on my part, because Uganda is in a dispensation of state capture. So what we need as a country is change at the very top, because the police has become an instrument of coercion, basically a political tool. Everything in it is politicized. Police is not known for efficiency. It's not known for being on the side of the people in terms of serving the people. So it has basically been bastardized. You only feel the presence of the police if you're doing something that annoys government. If you're in trouble, you need assistance, you'll never see the police. If robbers attack your home and you call what the Americans would be calling 911, you'll not get assistance. That's the truth in Uganda.
But the way some people are suggesting that Abbas Biakagaba has been trained as a police officer, and they expect him to lead the police in a different direction to maintain law and order and to protect life and property. And they believe he will be able to achieve that. Why are you doubtful?
You see, it would be the equivalent of pouring new wine into old skins, as the Bible would have put it, because it means you bring something nice in, but putting it in a context where it just cannot fit. Except that Biakagaba is retired, or was retired already, so he's basically still not exactly your spring chicken, and therefore It's really, I mean, even though he's elderly, by now he should be maybe getting less pressing assignments rather than being Inspector General of Police, because that's a huge, huge task. I don't think it would be good for his age. But at the same time, like I said, what matters most is what does the president want the police to do? And that's what Kagawa is going to do. It's not a revolution in any sense that, you know, we're going to see new things. There's nothing that's going to change. It will be the same old story. Police as a political tool to oppress Ugandans and basically to eat money when they get it.
As a human rights defender, what are your expectations?
Peter, like I said, this is hardly a matter for congratulations of any kind, because, like I said, the police force is of no consequence and is of no use to us as ordinary Ugandans. His brief will be basically to appease the powers that be. So, I mean, we've seen this before. What we need as a country is a change in the superstructure that has been superimposed on the country. A new government, a government that appreciates, that puts people at the center of its policies, a government that will look out for the people, that will want Uganda to become a better place.
Gawaya Tegule is a prominent human rights lawyer and a prolific legal writer. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. Still, David Kabanda is a member of the Ugandan Parliamentary Appointment Committee. The committee held a meeting with a new police chief. Kabanda tells me that lawmakers urge the new police chief to uphold the law, but not to be biased or be politically influenced.
First of all, I want to congratulate the new Inspector General of Police. And as a member of the Appointments Committee, today we interfaced with Mr. Byakagaba Abbas and his deputy designate. We interacted with them, and of course, we gave them the concerns of Ugandans. But my expectations to Mr. Byakagaba is to follow the Constitution, the rule of law in Uganda, not to be political. Because when you are a law officer, you are supposed to enforce law and order, but not to use force and to be guided by politicians or be driven by political decisions. I want to ask Mr. Byakagaba to follow the Constitution of Uganda, to follow the rule of law. That's how he will manage to serve Ugandans without any discrimination regarding our political affiliations.
You've had opposition groups expressing concern that he is not going to do anything different and that he will be used politically to crack down on the opposition or critics of the administration.
First of all, that issue was raised by the leader of opposition in the Appointments Committee, and he says some groups like the Patriotic League of Uganda have been allowed to conduct their rallies without being stopped by the police. But of course, his answer was very clear. Even you, the opposition groups in Uganda, once the police advises you that don't pass here, use this route, don't hold your rally in this stadium, hold your rally here, comply. But most of the opposition groups in Uganda and their leaders do not want to comply with the police. When the police tells you, don't pass here, don't pass there, don't fight with the police, because the police are there to enforce law and order.
Their concern is that the police use those restrictions they have to actually prevent their meetings from happening and using excuses like security concerns and all that. And the Constitution, they argue, allows for protest. And so when they engage in it, the police use their discretion to stop them, but doesn't stop the ruling parties. And that is the major concern they express.
The ruling party, where I belong, follows the Constitution. The Constitution says under the Public Order Management Act that whenever you are going to hold a public political rally, inform police. This informing police means that they will be able to guide you. Here, you are going to hold your rally near the market, near a church, near an office. Please, can you take your rally somewhere? The opposition in Uganda always want to engage themselves into a fracas with the police so that they can create news, the media people can cover them. You gain nothing in confronting with the police. You benefit a lot when you comply with the police and when they say, please hold your rally here. Don't go there. When you insist, of course, this enforcing law and order has to come out to stop you because you are going to harm other people who are not involved in your activities. They are doing their own things in business, in markets, but you want to affect their businesses.
David Kabanda is a member of the Ugandan Parliamentary Appointments Committee. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. In South Africa, many political analysts say opinion polls indicate a coalition of parties will run the affairs of the country after next week's elections. They also say the findings of the latest research show a continuous decline in support for the governing African National Congress, or the ANC. The latest poll released by the African Innovation Research suggests that the country's future lies in coalitions. It indicated there is concern about voter apathy among the youth ahead of the May 29 vote. It also shows that about 40% of respondents are either not interested in voting or did not register. For the latest political development, I reach David Everard. He is a professor at the School of Governance at Wits University in Johannesburg. And he tells me that no opposition party is likely to win enough votes to govern or lead a coalition.
I think it's inevitable. I don't think there's a single poll over the last 6 months that has put the ANC above 50%. And so, barring some completely unforeseen miracle or catastrophe, they're going to come in either where most polls are putting them, around 41-42%, or if they pull off, they've done a couple of big campaign promises on national health insurance and basic income grant. If those resonate well, they may pull themselves up to, I don't know, 46-47%. Either way, they will not be the majority party and they will have to make concessions.
What do you think has been the two major issues that has contributed to this, you know, less than 50% threshold that most polls have been showing in South Africa leading up to the election?
Well, I think firstly, it's a trend. It's, you know, the ANC has been declining since 2009, which was the first term of Jacob Zuma. And so it's following a natural trend line from the high of 70% in 2004 with Thabo Mbeki, just trending down and down and down. So at some level, the ANC has not worked hard enough to reinvent itself, to make it more attractive to voters. It's just assumed that it can carry on doing what it's doing, and that's wrong. But secondly, we also had almost a decade of state capture in which massive corruption occurred. We lost something like $70 billion from the economy, and we're not a big economy. And the ANC is directly implicated. It was ANC people who were doing it, and it's now an ANC government that is trying to clean up the mess that the ANC caused in the first place. And I think voters are saying enough is enough.
The polls also showed concerns about voter apathy. Do you think this is a reality? Because I understand some even prospective voters are still considering which of the political parties to vote for.
I have to admit, I hate the word voter apathy. I think it's political parties use it to kind of judge voters. But I look at it from the voter perspective. And that is, if you don't offer me something that excites me enough to go and vote, that's your problem. I'm not being apathetic. I'm just not seeing anything that attracts me. And I think that's what's happened. I think the opposition have failed to give a coherent message. So none of them are doing well. We don't have a single big rival party. The biggest party is sitting on about 23-24% of the vote. In a poll that came out this morning, 24% of voters were not able to declare who they would vote for. That doesn't mean they won't vote. It just means there's genuine bewilderment as to, out of all of these choices, can I make one choice at all?
The last poll that I saw Nkomto Weziri Party, or the MK Party led by Jacob Zuma, although a constitutional court has ruled that he cannot lead the party or cannot be in parliament. Do you see the EFF and the Nkonto Wesizwe party performing creditably in the coming elections?
Good question. I mean, I think what's happening is that Nkonto Wesizwe, or MK as it's known, I think it is directly challenging the EFF in the sense that they both talk very much to the poor and the working class. They're very Africanist. They're very happy to use quite aggressive and, if necessary, quite violent means of campaigning and protesting and so on. But I think MK is far more in that vein than the EFF. And so as MK grows, the EFF has been shrinking. And I think they're swapping votes from one to the other. I don't think either of them are going to come out of it very well as a result.
What about the Democratic Alliance? The last time I heard, they were trying to unite so-called the smaller political parties in order to pose any significant threat to the ANC in the coming elections. What about them?
Two questions there. I mean, if they had gone with what they called a multi-party charter, in other words, I think there were 11 parties together, if they had kept that together and unified, they would have posed a real threat to the ANC. All the polling suggests that. But instead, they've all started fighting each other. The smaller parties are now contesting for votes where the DA is in government. That's in the Western province. And they have fallen apart. And it seems that, as one colleague said to me the other day, that the Democratic Alliance seems to be struggling very hard to lose the election.
David Everard is a professor at the School of Governance at Wit University in Johannesburg. He spoke with me from Johannesburg. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English to Africa service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, in Zambia, Idris Ali Nasa, senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch, says the recent conviction and sentencing of a leading member of the Opposition Patriotic Front, or PF, would have a broad effect on freedom of expression in the country. His remark comes after Rafael Nakachinda, Secretary General of the PF, was convicted and sentenced to 18 months in prison with hard labor. This after he had accused President Hichilema of summoning judges to his residence to intimidate and force them into making decisions favorable to his administration. The international rights group called on the Zambian government to cancel Nakachinda's conviction, but supporters of the ruling party say law enforcement agencies must hold every Zambian who breaks the law accountable for their actions, irrespective of their status. For more about the call by Human Rights Watch, I reach Idris Ali Nasa.
Rafael Nakachinda is a leading opposition figure in Zambia, and we are very concerned as Human Rights Watch that he was convicted using a law. Not only is it a colonial era 1965 law that was used by previous leaders in Zambia to clamp down on civil society, opposition, media, and other critics, but also that this is a law that the current president of Zambia, Mr. Hakainde Hichilema, denounced while he was in opposition, that it was an unfair, unjust, and a law that should not be on the books of any democratic nation. So that's our first concern as Human Rights Watch regarding the conviction and sentencing of Rafael Nakachinda.
Part of your statement read that sending a leading opposition figure to prison under a law that previous administration notoriously used to silence critics is a blot on President Hichilema's record. But supporters are saying that that cannot be a true reflection of what is going on in the ground, especially when that person has been taken through the legal process and has been found guilty of committing a crime.
Indeed. You see, under the International Convention on Civil and Political Rights, which Zambia ratified in 1984, so those convicted of crimes must benefit from the imposition of lighter sentences. This is not a very light sentence by any stretch of the imagination. And secondly, Human Rights Watch has consistently opposed the criminal defamation laws, whose provisions send people to prison for nonviolent speech offenses. So Human Rights Watch, we say, in case where someone is offended by speech, nonviolent speech especially, then they can pursue that as a civil matter instead of sending critics, opposition, media, and political opponents to prison for non-violent speech. Further, the United Nations Human Rights Committee, you know, further states that, you know, on the freedom of expression, right, that imprisonment is never an appropriate penalty for defamation.
Some Zambians are saying, calling on the president to quash Nakachinde's conviction, basically it's calling on the president to interfere or undermine the rule of law, which they said will create chaos and instability.
I mean, we would want to echo the statement of the Chapter One Foundation in Zambia, which is an organization which promotes constitutionalism and the rule of law in that country, which says prosecuting Nakasinda using a law that was repealed, and it was repealed on the acknowledgement that that law undermines Zambia's democratic credentials, is quite problematic. And second of all, I think it also speaks to a broader deterioration of civil and political rights in Zambia, where there is a willingness to prosecute citizens who are critical of government, and that is very concerning. In addition to that, as Human Rights Watch, we are saying that the conviction and sentencing of Nakasinda actually speaks to broader issues of depriving people of their right to freedom of speech and other fundamental rights that are enshrined in the Zambian Constitution, as well as international standards that Zambia ascended to.
Supporters of the ruling party are saying that a lot of criticisms have been leveled against and continue to be leveled against President Nchelema. But then going to an extent, they argue that the allegations that the president summoned judges to his home to intimidate and coerce them into passing judgment favorable to him in legal battles with the opposition Patriotic Front basically creates division and instability, they argue. Your reaction to that?
I mean, all public figures in Zambia, including President Hakainde Hichilema himself, are legitimately subject to criticism. So, you know, elected public officials in a country that espouses democratic credentials should have a greater tolerance to criticism, scrutiny, and even some things that they may not personally like to be said about them. What is important, though, we should not lose focus of this, is that an environment should prevail that should allow Zambians to be able to exercise their basic rights and freedoms without fear of reprisals, without fear of being sent to jail for nonviolent speech, offenses.
Idris Ali Nasser is senior Africa researcher at Human Rights Watch. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. The Secretary General of Nigeria's Trade Union Congress, or TUC, says a minimum wage of $349 a month for public sector workers will help cushion the effects of the economic challenges facing the country. Nuhu Toru says the workers will embark on an indefinite strike to press home their demands if they are not met before May 31st. His remarks come as labor unions negotiate with the government for a new minimum wage. They rejected a suggested $38 a month for workers from the government, saying it is inadequate. For more information about the minimum wage negotiations with representatives from the government, I reach Nuhu Toro in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
What transpired yesterday is, in negotiation as organized labor, we don't go with fixation, which means we are flexible. And we most times are cautious, a little to the left and a little to the right, putting into consideration all the indices and the prevailing circumstances. So apparently, we came down a little. You know, the last time we discussed, I told you we don't have a fixation. We could tinker with the figure. So now we are asking for 497,000 for the workers to manage. It's not sufficient to take them in a month, but as patriotic Nigerians, we'll manage. Don't forget, we are also assisting government to beat the deadline of 31st of May, which will embark on an indefinite industrial action in the event if this is not dispensed with.
So moving forward, what was the major takeaway from the discussions you had following the agreement both you and your sister organization had? What was the major takeaway for you?
Well, the major takeaway is that we have researched, consulted widely with our members, and we have come to the conclusion that considering the high cost of living vis-a-vis inflation in Nigeria And the only thing that can reasonably take the worker home is 497,000 in a month. But don't forget, the government are still maintaining a hard stance. I have told you earlier that they didn't come to negotiation with a good faith. How can you be under an illusion to think that 48,000 naira will be able to sustain a worker, his wife, and four children in a month? The feed of a dog, Bingo, in Nigeria is now sold at the rate of 49,500. And even at that, the dog will consume that feed before the month ends. So this is what the politicians give their dogs in their houses. Are they equating us with the dogs? So workers deserve living wage. And we are resolute. We are determined. We will make sure that we get decent wage for Nigerian workers.
Does that mean that ongoing negotiations will continue with the government to at least increase the minimum wage again in spite of the recent agreement you had?
Well, we are not averse to negotiations. Like I told you earlier, we are open. We'll continue to dialogue. If they are ready, we are available. But one thing is sure, we will not allow anybody, I mean anybody, to undermine the value of the wages that accrues to the working people in Nigeria.
So with this agreement reached with the government following this week's meeting you had, is there a time frame again where negotiations will begin again about an increase? Will they be next year or 6 months? What time frame are you looking at here?
No, we are. It's effective from this month. It's effective from the month end. So our conclusion is that the minimum wage, the new national minimum wage, must set in effective from this month. So it's commencing this month.
Has the government agreed on it?
They don't need to agree. That is our position. At the end, I'm sure we'll find a way.
What is your message to public sector workers in Nigeria following this meeting with the government this week?
Well, our advice to Nigerian workers, especially in the public sectors, have been to remain calm and be rest assured that the Congress, under the leadership of Comrade Engineer Festus Osifo, will ensure that what is due to them gets to them in no distant time. And don't forget, when we brought up this notion of wage award, the whole essence is to cushion the effect until new minimum wage sets in. So head or tail, the workers still have some respite. The 35,000 wage award will subsist until a new minimum wage sets in.
Nu Toro is the Secretary General of Nigeria's Trade Union Congress, or TUC. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Today, May 25th, 2024, Africa celebrates the 60th anniversary of the Organization of African Unity, or OAU, and its successor, the African Union. On this day, 32 heads of state of independent countries and other stakeholders met to create the Organization of African Unity in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Officials from the African Union say the formation of the continental body was a manifestation of the Pan-African vision for a united and free continent that controls its own destiny. For analysis of the formation of the OAU and its prospect, I reach Dr. James Jonah. He is a former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs.
Well, the African Union is what followed the Constitution of African Unity. Prior to the formation in 1963 of the OAU, there were disputes among Africans as to how the continent should go forward. The prime mover was Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana. That first generation of Africans, like Nkrumah, Nyerere, they have a different point of view. They have experienced what happened in Europe during the war. And so they believe Africa should look for a continental government. They are looking for a kind of federal state. Well, frankly speaking, the West were not pleased with that. So they encouraged the formation of another group, a more moderate group, some call it the Monrovia group, who were saying, well, we are not sure we want to go into continental government with its own army and sort of, no. But something happened which changed all of their minds. The Congo operation, which began in 1960 and 1964, was the first serious challenge by ex-colonial power as to how Africans should govern themselves. Hammarskjöld created a force that should have preponderance of African troops, but not African troops near the Congo. But then immediately after the independence of the Congo, there was an attempt to balkanize the Congo. That why should you have such a large country, they said, with so much enormous wealth? And of course, the divide and rule came along.
Since its formation, the African Union or the Organization of African Union had a lot of promise to unite the continent, you know, to have it as an economic base and all that.
Under the first people.
So do you think the ambition with which it was and the vision with which it was established enjoyed some successes? And do you think the successes continued? Or it was abrogated?
No. Well, let me just give you so many successes. If you look at the literature, at that time, many people were arguing, political scientists, that Africa will be getting into fights among themselves because of the poor boundary demarcation. You know, there was a quarrel in Togo and Ghana and all of that. That's what the prediction. And they decided, look, they met in Cairo. They said, look, we understand this. It's not our fault. This is the colonialists, how they will do it. So they decided to come out with a ruling, a mighty success. They said, yes, please forgive me, be legitimate, but let us decide now in Cairo that all the boundaries which are inherited from the colonial powers will be accepted. And that comes lots of things. So that was a very, very big. Secondly, they were able to mediate between question of Algeria, Morocco, all of those things were done in quick order. They even said that African government should not allow foreign visits on their territory. I'm going to give you all of these things, but these were different people. They have a good concept. Then came a period of coups, and that changed everything. They have no clue, like no experience in doing that. But then, let me jump now, when Mbeki became the president of South Africa, a new generation, he started talking about the Renaissance of Africa. And in this Renaissance, they tried to model the European Union. And they make it, and they said all kinds of things which are not been true, that it will have more power than the OAU. No, there have been so much foreign influence in the management of the African Union.
Dr. James Jonah is a former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. He spoke with me from New York. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
He gave me love in abundance, a full bucket of roses. And there is a rukundati, I love the way he do that. Nafunyo no mulunji, and you mean a suti. At his and you mirror your body. Oh, I know you belong to me. We know who she is. I'm going to go to the house.
Ayo bo
That was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Douglas Mpuga and engineer the affable Tiang Weng. We say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, your elder brother cannot be on a mango tree and you will be eating on ripe mangoes. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa. Onye ko imagbono kuko ji mezeli ya.